Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, and recorded before a live audience. If you listened to the show last week, we spoke to Pulitzer Prize winner David McCullough about his new book, The Wright Brothers. Well, we'll continue that conversation this week. If you missed it, you can catch up at wamc.org. David McCullough is a two-time Pulitzer winner, a New York Times bestselling author, a master historian. The Wright brothers were regarded by many in their times as mere bicycle mechanics. Wilbur and Orville Wright were in reality self-taught geniuses of truly exceptional capacity of mind, pioneering scientific explorers, and the men who taught the world how to fly. David McCullough won Pulitzers for his biographies Truman and John Adams. The new book is The Wright Brothers. We begin the second part of our conversation by speaking about the Wright family and McCullough's style and preparation as a historian.
You write about their father, the bishop, that he had been born in a log cabin in Indiana in 1828 and had grown up with frontier ways and values. Though little is known about his mother, Catherine, his father, Dan Wright, a farmer and Revolutionary War veteran, had been a hero in the boy's eyes. That line, though little is known about his mother, Catherine, how much does that bother you when you're working?
A lot. Very often, the mother is illiterate. John Adams' mother was almost certainly illiterate. There's no letters that she ever wrote. There's no indication she could read and write. Think of that. But the idea that father was born in a log cabin and their mother's father was a wagon maker. And you go from a wagon maker to people flying airplanes in just three generations. The father, as an itinerant preacher, traveled all over the country, went to Panama, went everywhere, but always by rail or horse and buggy or wagon. And yet this all happens in such an accelerated fashion. What this wonderful story brings to us is a huge part of it in their own words, because the brothers and the sister Catherine and the father all were extraordinary letter writers, and they poured it out, and those letters have survived. There are over 1,000 professional or business letters in the Wright brothers' collection at the Library of Congress. And that's everything. That's their notebooks where they're calculating all the physics of flight and wing camber and the rest. Or writing letters to motor manufacturers requesting knowledge about their products and so on. That's all there. Stacks and stacks of it. But so are over 1,000 private family letters. Father, Catherine, two brothers. And they are phenomenal. Now, we aren't going to leave anything like such a trace of who we are, or where we've been, or what we think, or how we feel about life, or the country, or whatever. We're nothing. Future historians or biographers are going to have almost nothing to work with. No, nobody in public life today would dare keep a diary. No, they wouldn't, because it could be subpoenaed and used against you in court. If anybody has any interest in immortality, start keeping a diary. Keep it every day. Write about anything you want. And when you feel that the time's come, the curtain's going to come down, give it to the public library or to some university library, and it'll be quoted forever because it'll be the only one in existence.
In talking about letters, you write that Wilbur seated himself at Catherine's small slant-top desk in the front parlor to write what would be one of the most important letters of his life. Indeed, given all it set in motion, it was one of the most important letters in history. Addressed to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, it filled not quite two sheets of the Wright Cycle Company's pale blue stationery, all set down in Wilbur's notably clear hand. I ask you the question about the Smithsonian because this is a very up-and-down relationship that they had with the Smithsonian, which I found fascinating because I know how the story ends because I've seen the plane in the Smithsonian and the Air and Space Museum. But the fact that there was such friction between that institution and these brothers is fascinating.
Well, and as Wilbur acknowledged, and Orville did too, they owed so much to the Smithsonian, because in the letter he's asking the Smithsonian to send them everything they have on aviation. And they did. If not necessarily sending them the books, but the titles of the books and any pamphlets or papers that they had published. It was the raw material that got them really going and digging into it. Part of the problem was that Samuel Langley had developed what he called his aerodrome, which was looked like a giant insect. And it was to be launched from a huge houseboat, top of a huge houseboat in the Potomac River. And to develop this machine, he used public money, Smithsonian money. It doesn't sound like an awful lot today, but it was a fortune then, $50,000. And then he spent another $20,000 at least from private donations. So it cost well over $70,000. And there was all kinds of excitement about it and secrecy. And of course, he was one of the preeminent scientific figures in the world. And what it did when it took off was go up and dive right head first into the Potomac River twice. The Wright brothers' plane that they first flew at Kitty Hawk, including all the parts and pieces, materials, the expense of shipping it down from Ohio to North Carolina and the Outer Banks, all of that wound up costing less than $1,000. So it's one of the reasons why the federal government was a little leery about getting into another big experimental quest for it to succeed in aviation. Later on, a subsequent secretary or head of the Smithsonian decided that Langley's flying machine didn't fly because of the launching device. So he brought in Curtis, American aviator, and I shouldn't say secretly, but let's say with no publicity and no one allowed around to see what was going on, they made major revisions in the Langley aerodrome, and it sort of flew. Therefore, they announced, and then they changed all the revisions secretly that they had made and brought it back to the Smithsonian and announced that it was the first aviation machine to fly. Totally, a total scam. Absolutely inexcusable. When Orville found out that this was going on, he agreed to let the first airplane, the one that flew in 1903, the one he flew in 1903, I should say, go on loan to the museum in London. So off it went. And they were angry. They were bitter. Again, the government had not responded to them. Just as they had to go and demonstrate in France, now they had to give their historic achievement to the English. Only later on, when a new head of the Smithsonian came in and saw what had been pulled off, renounced that statement, declared that the Wright brothers were indeed the first to fly, was the plane, the Wright brothers' plane, returned from London and installed in the Smithsonian. But sadly, alas, by then Orville was no longer living. So they never lived to see their reputations restored by the Smithsonian. And now, of course, the Smithsonian is the great keeper of the history and of the flying machine.
These two men are so fascinating in your portrayal because they're very different. They each have different specialties and excel, but they are somewhat interchangeable in the story. They would often flip a coin to decide who was going to do what. They had many of the same skills that they were able to work together so closely.
Wilbur had a reach of mind that Orville did not have. Wilbur, as I said earlier, was a genius. Orville was brilliant and innovative in the extreme in mechanical creations. but he didn't have Wilbur's genius. He was also very shy. He couldn't get up and speak before an audience the way Wilbur could, didn't want to. Both of them did not long for the limelight. In fact, they tried to avoid it, if at all possible. Orville also had what in the family were known as his peculiar spells. He would get very touchy and blue and felt that people didn't understand him. And they could last more than a few days or they could last a few hours. The two of them, the two brothers, could get in horrific arguments, but they weren't mad at each other. It was their way of working out the answer to a problem, the solution to a problem. And they worked out extremely difficult problems. They invented the first motor ever built out of aluminum. They built a first wind tunnel and experimented on wing shapes with little pieces of hacksaw blades that they carved out themselves. They developed the design and curvature of propellers in a way nobody ever had. Every step along the way. At one point, they find out that all the data compiled by people like Langley and Octave Chanute and others was all wrong. And they've been going by it. And they found out it was all wrong because, unlike Langley or Chanute, they went up in a plane and tested it. They were the first test pilots. And they would get in an argument, and one would have this point of view and the other had that point of view. By the end of the day, they would have switched the point of views and were still arguing. They also could not have done it alone. Neither of them could have done it. Two heads were infinitely better than one. And I contend that the story would not have come out the way it did if it were not also for Catherine. She was a character. She stood only about 5'1". She had her hair pulled back in a bun and wore little gold-rimmed pince-nez eyeglasses. She was the essence of a schoolmarm. She taught Latin and Greek at the local Dayton High School. And as Orville would like to say, she flunked many of the city's leaders while students there. She was opinionated. She was funny, much more sociable than the brothers were. And she had a temper. She could get, as she said, wrathy. But she was always there when they needed her. And they needed her often, most dramatically, when Orville had a terrible crash at Fort Myer across the Potomac River from Washington, where he was demonstrating finally in 1908 for the War Department what the plane could do. And he had taken a young Army lieutenant up with him named Tom Selfridge. And Selfridge, sadly, tragically, was killed in the crash. First fatality in the history of aviation. Only a few days before, Theodore Roosevelt, the president, let it be known he'd like to go up for a ride. And he'd already gone down in the submarine, so this wasn't just talk. He meant it. And Orville was asked, would he be willing to take the president up if he wanted to go? And Orville said, yes, of course, if the president wants to go, I will. I advise that he not do that. He's the president of the United States. It's important that he not take that serious a risk. So he might have been the passenger very readily instead of Tom Selfridge. All this was in the paper, so it's not something that wasn't known at the time. But when Catherine heard that there had been the crash, it was in the afternoon, she called the high school principal and said, I'm taking an extended leave of absence. She packed and was on the next train to Washington, and she spent the next 6 weeks with Orville at the hospital at Fort Myer, looking after his every need, including his outlook on life, which was very badly damaged. His condition was serious, physically and mentally, and she got him through it. There was serious concern that he'd live, serious concern that he'd ever walk again if he did live, and no thought that he would ever fly again. He not only recovered, she took him to France, a trip to lessen his anxieties. He came back, and he not only was walking, but he flew again, and insisted on it was his decision to fly at Fort Myer. And when he flew, he broke several world's records. It is an absolutely amazing example of recovery and then some, but only with the help of her as a guiding spirit.
David McCullough's new book is The Wright Brothers. It's published by Simon & Schuster.
Talking about when they are in France, the French trying to figure these men out.
Yeah.
And you read about this a little bit, but there's one, an aviator and a sculptor and a painter who, speaking about Wilbur, says, has he a heart? Has he loved? Has he suffered? An enigma, a mystery.
And then what does he go on to say?
Wilbur Wright is the best example of strength of character that I've ever seen.
Yep. That's it. The other part of it, who can say? My feeling is that these two were perfectly normal in most ways. They certainly never had any peculiar traits about them. They didn't do funny things. They didn't do weird things.
Yeah.
But they had an objective, a purpose, and it sounds like a bad pun, a high purpose. And they were going to do that no matter what. And they just put everything else aside. And Wilbur was asked many, many times, why aren't you married? And don't you have any interest in women? He said, I haven't got time for that. And if they asked Orville, he'd say, he's my big brother. I can't do any of that until he goes first.
So not to be crass, did they die virgins?
I never had the chance to ask them. Now, that's the kind of thing they would not have written about. There's no way of knowing that.
But,
and, of course, we'd like to know all of that.
Of course.
There's always much more that you'd want to know. You long for the... Wouldn't it be great if I could interview them? But at the same time, particularly if you've got people who write letters such as the Adamses or Truman or the Wright brothers, you get to know them better than you know people in real life. Because in real life, you don't get to read other people's mail and their diaries. You were talking about the thinking that goes into a book.
Yes.
I remember reading John Adams' diaries, which are amazing. But every now and then, there'd be an entry, very simple entry. It would say, at home thinking. Imagine if somebody in Washington were to do that today. At home thinking. Do I have time for one story?
Absolutely. You can take as much time as you want.
We all had a terrible winter. It was terrible. It was brutal. It was a disaster. And there'd be a break between the blizzards, and you'd have to make your way to the market to get sufficient provisions to survive another week or more. So we made up a list, marketing list, and I agreed to go. And it was hard just getting there. It was Star Market, supermarket in Back Bay. I like going to the market. It's a weird thing, I know, but it's, to me, it's a little like going to the library. I like to look at all the things on the shelves and read the labels and everything. And I'd found everything on the list except the cashew nuts. And we love cashews, and I didn't want to not have that for the next siege. And so a fellow went by with a Star Market label on his shirt, and I said, excuse me, can you show me where the cashews are? And he said, yes, indeed, follow me. And we went around a couple corners, and he pointed out, and I thanked him very much. He went his way, and I went mine. And about 10 minutes later, I was checking out at the cash register, and he came up to me. He said, excuse me, that voice, your voice, have I heard your voice on television? I said, yes, probably. Good chance you have. He said, were you the narrator of the Ken Burns series on the Civil War? I said, yes, I was. He said, well, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. He said, that series came on at a time when I was really suffering from insomnia.
Ha, 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 ha.
Said I'd hear that voice and go right out.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
So I hope I have not had any of that effect on you here tonight.
Just as the last question I have is when you think of, for all that you mentioned, of what they were able to do that so many others were not able to do, without the money, without the backing, with all of the things that you mentioned, what do you believe just makes their story so incredible in the sense that you think that we may never see something like that again?
They wouldn't quit. They would not give up. Determination, fortitude, call it what you will. I want to read you an account, Orville's diary, kept when they were at Kitty Hawk. Now, put yourself in their places. They're out. It's nothing but sand, huge sand dunes, and wind. Very little in the way of population. No roads. No bridges over there. 100 and some miles or more of the Outer Banks, all the way down. No hospitals. No anything, really. Among the long-standing summer visitors to Nag's Head, the old wisdom was that the infamous Outer Banks skeeters struck en masse only once every 10 or 12 years. On July 18th, it suddenly became clear that 1901 was one of those years. As Orville wrote, the mosquitoes appeared in the form of a mighty cloud, almost darkening the sun. It was by far the worst experience of his life, he would tell Catherine. The agonies of typhoid fever were as nothing by comparison. There was no way of escaping the mosquitoes. The sand and grass and trees and hills and everything was fairly covered with them, he wrote in his diary. They chewed us clear through our underwear and socks. Lumps began swelling up all over my body like hen's eggs. We attempted to escape by going to bed, which we did at a little after 5 o'clock. We put our cots out under the awnings and wrapped up in our blankets with only our noses protruding from the folds, thus exposing the least possible surface to attack. Until then, the wind had been blowing at 20 miles an hour. Now it had dropped off entirely, and the summer heat kept mounting. Our blankets then became unbearable. The perspiration would roll off us in torrents. We would partly uncover, and the mosquitoes would swoop down upon us in vast multitudes. We would make a few desperate and vain slaps and again retire behind our blankets. Misery, misery. Morning brought little relief from the suffering. At first they tried working, but had to give it up. So unrelenting was the onslaught. In preparation for the night ahead, they built frames and mosquito nets for their cots, then moved the cots 20 to 30 feet from the tent and crawled in under the nets and again under their blankets. None of this worked. Such was the torture of the night that followed. Orville vowed that come morning, they would head for home. But with morning, however, their characteristic resolve returned. They didn't give up. Now that is the most vivid, horrible torment that they experienced without giving up. I myself know I would have been out of there in no time. But there was also the mental strain of failure. They failed time and again. They found that things that they thought would work didn't work. And they crashed. They crashed more than once, both of them did. And yet they wouldn't quit. They would not give up. And I think that's admirable in the extreme.
I cannot tell you what a great pleasure and thrill it has been to speak with you and how much I have admired you and your work. And it is a great honor to have you on this program, and I thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, sir.
A great pleasure.
Thank you.
David McCullough, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Again, David McCullough's new book is The Wright Brothers. It's published by Simon & Schuster. A reminder, you can listen again to this or listen to the first part of this interview by going to wamc.org. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the book show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Saratoga Springs, New York, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.